And the theme of what we're going to run through are twofold. Number one, no one accidentally shares the gospel. Theme number two, that it is really a prioritized commitment that we make and an endeavor. And so we're going to look at some of the stories from his book, Tell Someone, and I'm glad that that's available today. It's a very readable book, and I'll quote a little bit from it, although I'll be summarizing since he stole a lot of my thunder with his sermon, but we're going to spend some time looking at those passages as well. I'm going to end with a video that I think you'll enjoy watching, and that will be part of it. So turn with me, if you would, to Acts Chapter 8. We're going to look at three different illustrations in the scriptures. And in Acts chapter 8, we have, again, a fascinating story of the Ethiopian eunuch. And we'll start, first of all, with verses 26 and 27, because we're going to be looking at this particular set of circumstances. And here we see that Philip has been in Samaria. And now he would normally have headed back to Jerusalem. That was sort of the base of operations. But verse 26, now an angel of the Lord said to Philip, rise and go toward the south to the road that goes down from Jerusalem to Gaza. This is a desert place. And he arose and went. And there was an Ethiopian, a eunuch, a court official of Candace, queen of the Ethiopians, who was in charge of all her treasure. He had come to Jerusalem to worship. And so, first of all, we see this emphasis on this idea of him being in one location and would have headed back to Jerusalem, but instead, after this revival in which he's preached, he saw many people repent and believe and were baptized. Now, on his way back, the angel of the Lord directs him in a different way. And so we begin to see something remarkably different. If you can see on the screen there, I've added this, you can see that, first of all, he is up in Jerusalem. That's where they were after Stephen was stoned. He goes for a short period of time just north to Judea, and now he is up there in Samaria, kind of in the middle there, number three. Number four, they have preached and had the revival. And you can see, if you're not familiar, that he would have just come straight south. But instead, he is directed all the way over to this road to Gaza, which today we call the Gaza Strip, interestingly enough. And so you can see that by being available, he now is quite willing to go to a different place and see what the Lord might have for him to do. And so I think it's very illustrative of the fact that he just didn't stumble upon this opportunity to do this, but actually he heard and heeded God's voice to go and make an intentional commitment. So the point we're making is that sometimes evangelism is determined by our desire to go and do something very specific. And as I put up there on the screen, no one accidentally shares his or her faith, articulates the gospel. It's a commitment to really obey God and Christ's command and to actively seek an opportunity at the Spirit's prompting. Today, Greg Laurie used a couple of illustrations. One about wanting to spend time with his mother, who I've seen pictures of her, was a very beautiful woman and used her beauty in the most inappropriate ways possible. Married and divorced 7 times. He was in studio with us Thursday. He was sharing a little bit more about some of the experiences, which probably are more PG-13 or R-rated, so we won't talk about them today. But nevertheless, felt the need that it was time to really confront his mother and say, even though she says we're not going to talk about it, did deliberately do so. Then he talks about the other friend. This was one of the husbands. It's hard to keep them all straight, by the way, because I'm going to talk about another husband in just a minute, who actually was one of the nicest of the bunch, and again, was going to the airport to catch a plane, but still felt the prompting from God to go and to share that. And by the time he had landed in his speaking opportunity, got a text and said that he had died. So the point we're making is that there are sometimes when we just have to recognize that we need to follow the prompting of the Holy Spirit. If you've been in a situation where God says, you know, I think you need to talk to this person, there's always a tendency for some of us to say, no, maybe another time. And yet I think it's illustrative of the fact that Jesus called us fishers of men. And I thought this was kind of interesting that someone pointed out. You know, have you ever heard of anybody waking up in the morning, getting dressed, preparing to go to work, and accidentally catching fish on their way to work? No, I mean, you have to obviously, if you're a fisherman, do this. I even thought about bringing a fishing pole in here to illustrate the point. Obviously, you have to be a little bit more deliberate In order to catch fish, you have to have a body of water, you have to take the necessary tools, and you have to be committed to it. And so I think the point is that sometimes we need to recognize that God is calling for us to be making a very deliberate commitment to those individuals. A believer's commitment to share his or her faith must be intentional. A fisherman that doesn't frequent a stream or a lake isn't going to catch any fish. Likewise, we need to be aware of all sorts of different opportunities. And you had him share one of those today, but I thought we'd go into it a little bit more detail, because when he talked about Jonah, I thought it was very interesting, because here Jonah was actually convinced that the last place he wanted to go was to Nineveh because of the Assyrians. And he said, to sum it up, I love what he said. God said, go. Jonah said, no. And God said, oh. And then he goes on to say, know this, the Lord will always have the last word. You probably know the rest of the story. A great storm overcame Jonah's ship. He was thrown overboard and swallowed by a massive fish, perhaps a whale. The word in Hebrew is actually sea monster. There is a belly of the beast after 3 days, a stubborn rebellion. Jonah finally came to his senses. He repented of his sin and stubbornness and was recommissioned by God. And that sea creature came to the shore of the place the Lord originally told Jonah to go and vomited him up there. There is no getting out of this as far as the Lord is concerned. It was Nineveh or bust. So Jonah was repentant, now regurgitated, believing and barfed. Gotta love Craig. righteous and ralphed. Right on the shore of the nation he did not want to go. He was the right man in the right place, at the right place, be it all the time of the odor on him. And he goes into the whole detail about how this was a changing and turning point in the life of Jonah. He shared a little bit of the story, so I won't go through the rest of it, but it's fascinating in the book to just talk about that as well. Let's go on and pick up where we left off, because now in verse 28, it tells us about the eunuch, and said he was returning, he's seated in his chariot, and he was reading the prophet Isaiah. Goes on to say, and the Spirit said to Philip, go over there and join this chariot. So Philip ran over to him, heard him reading Isaiah the prophet, and asked, do you understand what you're reading? And he said, how can I understand unless someone guides me? And he invited Philip to come up and sit with him. Now the passage of the scripture that he was reading was this, like a sheep he was led to the slaughter, like a lamb before its shearers is silent, so he opens not his mouth. In his humiliation, justice was denied him. Who can describe his generation? For his life is taken away from this earth. And the eunuch said to Philip, about whom, I ask you, does this prophet say this? About himself or someone else? Then Philip opened his mouth, and beginning with the scripture, he told him the good news about Jesus. And as they were going along the road, they came to some water. And the eunuch said, see, here is water. What prevents me from being baptized? And he commanded the chariot to stop, and they both went down into the water, Philip and the eunuch, and he was baptized. And then they came up out of the water, and the Spirit of the Lord carried Philip away, and the eunuch saw him no more and went on rejoicing. But Philip found himself as Azotus, and as he passed through preaching, eventually ended up in Caesarea, which is part of the map I just showed you a minute ago. And I think we see kind of interesting illustration here, because the second principle is sometimes earn the right to be invited. You know, Philip was an apostle, but what we find here is the eunuch was a high-ranking official with the Ethiopian queen. So only really the economically elite were the ones that would travel in chariots and enjoy the luxury of a chariot as the eunuch did enjoy. And Philip instead saw this as a God-given opportunity. There's obviously a gap. Imagine, you know, going to a rich person. We've got a billionaire running for office right now. We've got a lot of billionaires here. You can imagine there's sort of a gap. But imagine in that day there's a real gap economically. But nevertheless, took this as an opportunity instead of saying, well, he's rich. I can't really get on a chariot. I'm an apostle. I'm really kind of despised right now. Stephen was just killed. I'm trying to escape from any kind of persecution, but instead saw this as an opportunity. When he heard the man reading the scriptures, he ran over and engaged in a conversation and asked him if he understood what he was reading. And so again, we see how this was used in a very dramatic way because of what was actually taking place in that first century. I think the obvious implication is, you know, right now we live in a time where most of our neighbors and co-workers and classmates and others have enough knowledge about Jesus and his church that they're actually sometimes disinterested. And so I think what we're going to have to do, especially in this area of North Dallas, is to recognize that we have a lot of people that probably understand a little bit about the church, know a little bit about Christianity. Today he had us all quote John 3:16. We run into people that probably could quote John 3:16, but they've never really believed it. Or maybe they've strayed, like he talked about his mother straying away. And so the issue isn't knowledge as much as it is trust. And so I think we're going to have to consider what it is. And even so, I put up here, you know, we have some people that are scared of the church. Frankly, we have some other people that are scarred by the church. I'm running into more and more individuals now that are saying, you know, I've tried that church experience and that didn't work out for me. And one of the stories, of course, that he told was, you know, go into the world. Even the restroom was what he called. And so those of you this morning heard, in case you didn't hear, goes into a restroom in a department store in a stall. And again, guys, we all know that you don't even make eye contact with another guy there. And all of a sudden, when the guy next to him says, hi, you know, do you have something for me? And he wanted to make a drug bust. And I love this because he says, do you know who I am? I'm Greg Glory, the pastor of Harvest Christian Fellowship. There's a moment of silence and he said, oh my God. Then he said, I had to laugh. I said, buddy, God must really love you. Here you are trying to make a drug buy and the Lord sends your pastor to deter you. And then he went on to said, I wanted to tell him that he needed to make a recommitment to Christ, but he said, I was tired of this bathroom ministry, so I told him to meet outside in the sock department, which was nearby. He was easy to spot. He was the guilty guy looking as he walked out, and then we prayed together and made a recommitment to follow Jesus Christ. So sometimes we have to recognize that there are people that maybe said, oh, I tried that Christianity, but it didn't work for me. And here there was a good example that he used just a few minutes ago of an individual that indeed had done that as well. So my argument is in this first illustration, let us learn from Philip for just a minute. We sometimes earn the right to ask someone to come if we're obedient by willing to go. And I think we've seen how important that really is. And we're going to have to go into a world where there's a lot of doubting people that maybe know something about Christianity, but they've never trusted him personally. And also, I think it's important to heed God's call to seek opportunities to speak and to maximize God's divine doors to really begin to invest in individuals. And that's going to be really important for us as well to do. Let's move on then. We've looked at the first of three illustrations. The second one, just a few pages to the right, is in Acts 16. And in this particular case, we're going to look at a situation that unfolds in a jail. And what we see here, interestingly enough, in verse 16, chapter 16, verse 25, let me start right there, is that at midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns to God, and the prisoners were listening to them. Now, the context is pretty simple, because what we have here is Paul and Silas, who have been teaching and preaching. They have actually, because of a particular intervention, actually freed a woman from a demon spirit, but that slave girl was actually being used to generate income for individuals. And so here, we see them imprisoned for doing good work. They haven't done anything wrong. As a matter of fact, they've done everything right. They've preached the gospel, which is a good thing. They've actually had an exorcism and removed a demon from this slave girl. But instead of being rewarded for their good work, they find themselves in prison because the men that she was with actually now were infuriated because now their cash cow no longer is able to actually be used. And so they find themselves in prison. The charges that were leveled on them were that they were disturbing the city and advocating customs that were not lawful. And it turns out, for those of you that maybe have ever traveled with this church to Greece, and I'm going to be doing one of those tours a little bit later, when you go to Philippi, it was one of these Roman colonies. And in the Roman colonies, it was still lawful for an individual to hold to a different religious view. So it was very pluralistic in one sense, but it was unlawful to be engaged in proselytizing. So if they had just simply lived out their Christian life and not been sharing the gospel, everything would have been fine. But of course, they not only did that, but they also caused one set of men to lose their economic cash cow because now she was no longer able to prophesy. And there's a second thing, and that is we read about this a little later in the book of Acts as well, that this happened at a time when the Emperor Claudius actually banned Jews from Rome, and so now there was sort of an anti-Semitic element to it as well. So the point I'm making is by the time you find Paul and Silas in jail, in chapter 16, verse 25, about the last thing you think they would be doing, especially at midnight, is doing what? Singing, right? Think about this. I mean, it had to have been an incredible emotional toil. They're now in jail once again. And instead of them pleading their case or expressing some kind of displeasure or wanting to have a lawyer or whatever it is, instead you have them singing and you have this joyful praise, which no doubt caught the attention of the other prisoners and perhaps the jailer himself. And that's going to be very important in just a minute. The point I'm making is that oftentimes before any gospel-centered conversation that we may be engaged in, certainly I think what is important for us to do is to live a godly life before unbelievers. In this case, anybody within earshot probably saw that everybody else is probably moaning, complaining, or probably even asleep for that matter at midnight. Instead, what you see here is that they are actually responding to their unmerited circumstances with a hope that certainly, I think, caught a lot of the prisoners and, as we're going to see in just a minute, maybe even the jailer himself off guard. Also, of course, their response in this case was to God's character and not their circumstances. And so one of the things that Greg Laurie was sharing about, and he talked about this again today, and it's in his book. You know, he was out at a crusade, and he saw on this beach this guy, you know, the wages of sin is death, you know, and you saw what he said. Can't you put the other part of it on the other side? And the guy, you know, was a terrible testimony to the gospel. I have people calling in my radio show sometimes, and after hearing him tell that story and read it in the book, I'm thinking, maybe I should tell some of them, don't tell anybody you're a Christian because your attitude is so bad that you're probably doing more harm than good. But the positive aspect of that is by living a godly life, I think there are going to be some people who are going to say, what is it about you? You seem really different. I mean, if you're in that jail and everybody else is moaning and complaining and they're over there singing, you go, I don't know what they've got, but I want some of it. Now, you might think it's alcohol, but you don't know what it is, but you just know that there's something very different about the people in that cell compared to all the other people in all the other cells. And I think likewise here, we see them rejoicing and really painting, as I point, a clear picture of what the inmates and the jailer would not have actually recognized. And so in some respects, they might have been somewhat awestruck indeed by their response to their circumstances. Also, I think it earned them the opportunity to begin speaking truth to the jailer, which we're going to see in just a minute. You've sort of earned the right to begin to speak. And here you see this. And obviously, as I pointed out before, many believers sometimes cause harm because of their dispositions. We obviously can't control our circumstances, but we certainly can control the way in which, indeed, we respond to those circumstances. So let's pick up the rest of the story. Verse 26. And suddenly there was a great earthquake, so that the foundations of the prison were shaken. And immediately all the doors were opened and everybody's bonds were unfastened. When the jailer woke and saw that the prison doors were open, he drew his sword and was about to kill himself, supposing that the prisoners had escaped. So now we see that this has a parallel, interesting enough, to what we could read just a few chapters earlier in Acts 12. If you remember in Acts 12, what happened there, that's where Peter actually is able to leave. The angel frees him, and then they have a prayer meeting, and they're praying for Peter, and they hear a knock on the door, and it's Peter that they were praying for. But you might remember the rest of the story. After, indeed, Herod finds out that Peter has escaped, what does he do? He kills what? Those jailers who were responsible for Peter's detention. And so this jailer now obviously figures out that his consequence is going to be the same. Obviously, it's in Philippi, it's not in Jerusalem, but he knows the rule. That is, if the prisoners have escaped, the first person to be killed is the jailer. And so here we see that instead the disciples have a choice. In this case, the angel does not tell them to leave. So here we see, I think, an interesting little contrast. The disciples in this case decided to prefer that they would stay. And so instead of getting their freedom, they're now going to give the jailer freedom from sin. Instead of being freed from captivity in the jail, they're going to free the jailer from his captivity. And you can see that in some respects there's an obvious principle here, and that is if we're going to be really effective in evangelism, sometimes it requires that we put ourselves last rather than first. Our desires, our comfort, our finances, our schedule may sometimes have to play a secondary role. And Greg gave me a great illustration today. He's going to the airport. If there's ever a time when you don't want to miss a plane, especially when you're coming to a speaking engagement, that's the case. But he was willing to take a chance and to go and share his faith with an individual who needed to hear that on death's door. And here we see that the believers are confronted with divine appointments that in some cases really been orchestrated that the gospel might be shared. And so really the question is not whether or not you will have an opportunity to be used to evangelize, but instead, what will you do with the opportunities that you have? Certainly you need to begin to think about what you're going to do. And here you can see that the lost were close to the heart of Paul, and his priorities were informed in that way. So let's continue on, because now in verse 27, we've had him drawing his sword. Let's pick up where it says after that. But Paul cried out with a loud voice, "Do not harm yourself, for we are all here." And the jailer called for lights and rushed in, and trembling with fear, fell down before Paul and Silas. Then he brought them out and said, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" Don't you love that question? I mean, every once in a while you do get people in an evangelistic opportunity to simply ask, "How can I be saved?" And they said, "Believe in the Lord Jesus Christ and you will be saved, you and your household." And they spoke the word of the Lord to him, to all who were in his house. And he took them that same hour that night and washed their wounds. And he was baptized at once, he and all his family. Then they brought them out up into his house and set food before them and rejoiced among them, for with his entire household they believed in God. And so here we can see that once again, we see the consequences, understanding the consequences of the escape for the prisoners. The jailer was ready to take his life, but instead now Paul screams out and saves his life. But more than that, it isn't just to save his life, it is to save him from sin. He gauged the situation and addressed the man's needs, and so again, they were accounted for. No harm could befall the jailer. And it brings us to another principle, and that is sometimes we have the perceived need, and sometimes we have the actual need. And we could see that as even today, Greg Laurie was talking about the woman, the Samaritan woman. What was her perceived need? Well, it's to get some water, come back. And she even perceived Jesus' need is, "Give me water." But he turned that intact, as he was sharing with us today, from the perceived need of water to living water. And the perceived need we have here is certainly those things which people believe are real. And oftentimes our goal in evangelism is to move from their perceived need. I need more power. I need more influence. I need more money. I need more people to like me. I need to be successful. I need a new car. I need someone to help me with my bills. I need health. Whatever it might be, to turn them to their real need, and that is their need for Jesus Christ. And so again, effectively communicating the gospel in many cases requires us to acknowledge the perceived need of those who are lost, but then to recognize that those perceived needs need to receive love from others, to be recognized at work, to engage in romantic relationships, but a litany of others, but then to actually show them their actual need in Jesus. And sometimes one of the most important parts of our evangelism is to begin to help them see what they really need. I think it's interesting if you think about what was actually happening there, because the jailer must have heard the disciples singing, must have noticed that there was something a little bit different. And certainly when he discovered that they stayed rather than run, at this point he's got to know, what is it that is so different about you? What do I need to do to be saved? And the result of what he heard and his interaction led him to seek salvation. And of course we see that not only was he saved, but his whole family was saved as well. So that's our second illustration, but in order to end on time, let's get to our third illustration, and we'll find that in the book of Matthew. And here we see something a little bit different. Because here, it's about Matthew, but it's in the book of Luke, we see that this particular case, we learn a couple of other principles. And the first of those is the decision that we need to make to be impartial. In this case, Jesus provides us with a great model of what that looks like. And we first of all see that in verse 27 of chapter 5, "And this he went out and saw a tax collector named Levi sitting at the tax booth. And he said to him, 'Follow me.' And leaving everything, he arose and followed him." And so the first principle here is that Jesus is willing to go out and to meet a tax collector. Now, you know enough about tax collectors to know what that was like in the ancient world. Because what you have here is a job, an occupation, which is really good for somebody that has no scruples, no kind of honesty. Because what they would do is come up to their fellow Jews, and they would say, "You owe this amount of tax." The Roman Empire only required this amount of tax, but they would ask for so much more. So they survived by overtaxing their fellow Jews. In some cases, these were individuals. If you think about it, Levi, no doubt, went through rabbinical school. These are individuals that knew the Old Testament. These were Jews that were expecting the coming Messiah. But instead, they turned their back on all their Jewish training and instead were the greatest, if you will, betrayers of their own race that you can possibly imagine. When tax collectors were mentioned, they were at the very bottom of the list. And here, Jesus now is willing to go and actually deal with that. As I point up here, tax collectors were hated. They were often very dishonest and disrespected and disgusting to almost everybody. There was not anyone that could really have any great positive feeling towards a tax collector. These are the people that you dread. We have a little of that today. You know, when you get something in the mail from the Internal Revenue Service. You know how you feel when you get that? Okay, put that on steroids. And this is kind of the feeling that anybody would have when they would confront a tax collector. But imagine if it was somebody of your own family, somebody in your own community, somebody who you know was actually involved in all sorts of extortion and graft. This is the kind of attitude that people would have as, indeed, Jesus comes up to this individual and now, showing perfect impartiality, approaches Matthew while he's sitting in his tax booth and tells him to leave this profession of dishonesty and follow a life of truth. So let's now see what, indeed, that looks like, because we can see in verse 28 how that plays itself out. And he says, "And leaving everything, he arose and followed him." The next verse then goes on to say that he had a great feast. Look at verse 29. "And Levi made him a great feast in the house, and there was a great company of tax collectors and others reclining at a table with them." Okay, this has gone from bad to worse. It's bad enough to have one tax collector. It's really bad to have a handful of tax collectors. Now, Jesus is surrounded by these disreputable individuals. And instead, Jesus reclines with them as well. And then we see the next part of this in verse 29. And that is, "And Levi made, as it said, a great feast. And the Pharisees and scribes grumbled at the disciples, saying, 'Why do you eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners?'" You know, if you say tax collectors and sinners, it was kind of like talking about biased media. You're being redundant. You know what I mean? You know, there's a kind of, because that was what the category was. When they talked about sinners, they always were thinking tax collectors. But instead, here you see that Matthew wastes no time in inviting his friends to Jesus and using that as a great evangelistic opportunity. And interestingly enough, there's no magic words to memorize. There's no formal training to accomplish, no prerequisite for evangelism other than knowing and enjoying Jesus. And there are two really good chapters in this book about how you can turn your personal testimony into a very effective witness tool. And I love what Greg Laurie says. It's effective in two ways. First of all, everybody has a story. Most people are somewhat interested in your story. They like to talk about themselves, but they're kind of interested a little bit in your story. And more importantly, it's one of those times where you can just tell the story and you're telling the gospel without it looking like you're preaching at them. And so he's got some great suggestions there about just recognizing that even here, Matthew, or you can use the example he just used a few minutes ago, the woman at the well, The Samaritan woman, she goes back and she begins to share. Now, she's just become a Christian, right? She's just accepted Jesus as Messiah. She probably doesn't know a whole lot. It's quite honest, except for the fact that Levi might be able to remember a few things from rabbinical school. He doesn't know a great deal. But look at the fact that they are already sharing their faith. And Greg, I'll save in the interest of time, tells a great story about within a week after becoming a Christian, of having a Bible in his hands and being afraid to actually use the Bible to witness to someone, so he leaves it outside as he goes into this house where they're doing drugs. But before he could even begin to share his faith, the mother saw him stick it in the bushes and said, "Whose Bible is this?" You know? Now think about this. They're doing drugs in the house. But she's not upset about the drugs. She's upset about somebody brought a Bible. And it wasn't exactly the most effective witnessing technique that Greg Laurie ever had. But the bottom line is, you have a story. And as he said, if you know John 3:16, you know quite a bit. And you at least know enough to talk about what happened before you became a Christian, how you became a Christian, and what has happened since then. And don't embellish it, as he says in the book, but use that to tell a little bit more of the story as well. And let's continue here, because here we see Matthew jumped up from the tax booth, where he was, in a sense, living in sin, where sin was the king of his life. And he brings Jesus to his house for the purpose of throwing a party to introduce his other sinful individuals, tax-collecting friends, to Jesus. And so what a great opportunity. Matthew, of course, responded to Jesus' call by immediately going home, hosting a party for his Jesus and tax-collecting friends. And so this, I think, illustrates again, you can just maybe have an event even in your own home. And there are all sorts of videos that we can certainly use that as well. He took his circle of influence and relationships that God has given to him and used it for the gospel opportunity. Out there on the table, we have these, and those are a place for you to actually think about even this week, the individuals that you have maybe already been praying for, but encourage you to pray for and to really consider inviting. We've got some other things. Of course, we've got the brochures, we've got the stickers, we've got all sorts of things that we have. But what we want to do is recognize that the clock is ticking. This time next week, it's going to be almost too late to invite somebody. So this is the last week to really get serious about thinking about your circle of friends. 2 weeks ago, you might have seen the video where we had the tic-tac-toe, put you in the center and look around. Your neighbors, are there some neighbors you can talk to? Are there some sphere of influence? Are there some relatives that you can influence as well? And here we see Matthew, what's the only group he knows? Fellow tax collectors. Probably didn't know anybody else. And if he had any friends at all, they were all fellow tax collectors. What a great opportunity to bring them to the Lord. In our response, certainly, chances are that you don't have to go very far to find people in your circle who don't know Christ. And as Greg Laurie shared, and he shares this in his book, you don't have to say, "I want to be a missionary to go overseas." How about just going across the street? And again, when we think of mission, sometimes we think of life being something where we get in an airplane, we get on a boat, and we go overseas. Sometimes the most difficult mission field is just right across the street or your neighbor's next door. So consider what you might do in the next couple of weeks to do that. Again, the point I want to make is God has placed you there for a purpose. And that purpose is ultimately to share the gospel. He does say some things in the book as well about how, in some respects, you have the sin of, remember, commission and the sin of omission. And if we're unwilling to share our faith, you know, in some respects, that could be sin. So again, he's placed you in an office or in a classroom or a house or a grocery store or a neighborhood somewhere, and that's where you can be a missionary. You can prepare a meal. You invite your circles of friends. You can bring a table. You don't even have to go to AT&T Stadium. You could actually have a computer up in your home, and you could have an evangelistic outreach right there in your home if you wanted to. But I hope a lot of you will be one of those 100,000 people out there at the stadium. It's going to be a really great event. Well, just before we wind down, though, let me show a video which I think might be a good way to just remind us of the fact that we are to be his disciples and we are to be his evangelists. So let's, if we can, maybe see what indeed God will do through you. Thank you.
Very good. Just before I wind down here, there is at least one story that Greg didn't steal from me, so I thought I would share that one before we go. And there were so many I had planned, but I'm glad to have him tell the stories because he's better telling the stories than I am. But you know that his last name is Lori, and it turns out that that was not his biological father. It was not even the first father he grew up with, but it was an individual that his mother, married. And interestingly enough, even though she had had a number of lovers, a number of one-night stands, for some reason she was attracted to this one man, Oscar Felix Lori. Oscar Felix Lori was different than any of the other men. Most of them were kind of like barflies. But this was a man that was actually a lawyer, fine, upstanding. As a matter of fact, he was so influential in Greg's life that, of course, he not only took on his name and was adopted. Later on, he actually tried to actually get Greg from his mother, and she fought him tooth and nail, why he never really understood. But after Greg became a Christian, and after he became a pastor, he decided that maybe he would like to look up his father, the one that had the only really positive male influence in his life, back in New Jersey. And so Oscar, he said, was known for his honesty and personal integrity. He was a well-respected attorney practicing on the East Coast and was well on his way to a judgeship. Oscar did not just marry my mother, he also adopted me, was the only man in my tumultuous Christian life and childhood that ever treated me as a father should treat a son. Out of the blue, my mother left him one day, and that's where she picked him up at the airport in New Jersey. They flew to Hawaii, and he never saw him again. But he found out later that Oscar tried to actually get custody of him. Well, anyway, he actually snapped at that point and sort of gave up, became a Christian, and then began to decide that it would be maybe worthwhile to go and to actually deal with Oscar and to see whether or not that would be an opportunity. So I'm trying to find where it is. Yeah, okay, here it is. Fast forward 10 years later, I'm the pastor of the church that we planted in Riverside, California. It was having explosive growth, but it said I at one point really thought it would be good to reconnect with my sort of only positive male role model that I'd ever had. And I tracked him down in New Jersey. And after a short phone conversation, Oscar was eager to reconnect, and he asked me to come and visit him in his hometown and meet his new family. So when Kathy, Christopher, and I disembarked from the train, they carried us from New York City to New Jersey, where they were waiting there. This is the first time I'd seen my dad in many years. It was though he picked up right where we left off. We spent hours talking about what happened in the time since we last saw each other. I discovered he tried to get custody of me. That evening, his wife Barbara cooked a delicious Italian meal, and she asked me to tell how I had become a Christian and a pastor. As I told my story, Barbara was very responsive, asking questions and really engaging. In sharp contrast, my father, Oscar Lori, the attorney, sat at the other end of the table, hands pressed together in front of his face, listening intently to every word, but not showing any visible emotion. I felt as though the judge was listening to my testimony in a court of law, and I was not doing well. After finishing my story, Barbara thanked me, hugged me. My dad said he'd like to see me in the morning. And his father had had a heart attack, and so he actually had to go out and exercise every morning. So he suggested, let's go out and go for a walk. So he knocked on Greg Laurie's door at 6 a.m. Now, for those of you that have lived in California and you go to New Jersey, that's 3 a.m. California time. You with me on this? Okay, so he is as groggy as he can possibly be. I was still rubbing the sleep out of my eyes as we stepped out of the house into the brisk New Jersey morning. Oscar said, Greg, I've been listening very carefully to everything you said last night about Jesus Christ. Oh, good, I mumbled. Then he dropped the bombshell. Greg, I would like to commit my life to follow Jesus Christ right now. I could hardly believe my ears, for I did not think what I had said the night before had any impact at all on him. I had not planned on or expected such response to the gospel. Dad, I said, let me go over it one more time. And when he was on the show Thursday, he said, I was convinced he didn't really understood. That's why he said what he said. He patiently listened as he explained who Jesus was, why he came, and how the person could come into a personal relationship with him. And he said, well, and so he said he wanted to do just that. And I said, well, Dad, you can pray that right now and ask Jesus into you your life if you like. To my surprise, my father, respected attorney and heart attack survivor, dropped to his knees. Now, they're out there in a park where there's still dew on the ground, okay? And he's now on his knees in the middle of the park in New Jersey at about 6:30 in the morning. Not planning on kneeling for this prayer, but since he is already down, I joined him in the dew-covered park, and we walked together, we prayed, and Oscar Felix had his eternal address changed that day. He ends the story there, but on Thursday on the interview, and I'll be glad to make you a CD of it, he told the rest of the story, which is not in the book, and I don't know why I left it off. As soon as he gets up, his father says, "That has healed my heart." He said, "Well, I know. I mean, now you have Jesus living." He said, "No, you don't understand. I think God has healed my heart." And Greg's like, "Well, I'm not so sure about this. I mean, I know he spiritually healed your heart." He says, "No, I'm convinced that I've been healed." And he says, "My doctor, my cardiologist over here, I'm going to go and we're going to go." And Greg's like, "Oh, this is not exactly what I thought we were in for." And they go in and his heart was healed instantaneously. So not only was he physically and spiritually healed, but he is praying to receive Jesus Christ in the dew-covered ground there in the park. And as I said when we did that interview, there are some stories in this book that if it does not light your fire, your wood is wet. And I thought, if nothing else, this is just a good way to recognize that you may have an opportunity to heal an individual even more than you might have actually understood. And so that's why I encourage all of us to take some of these lessons on evangelism and apply them as we go to Harvest America next Sunday. EJ?